This episode of Super Pulp Science is brought to you by the Manitoba Book Award losing illustrated novella Automatic Age by GMB Kamichuk. It's a perfect world, but people are not allowed to live in it.
Attention, citizens, it's time for Super Pulp Science.
Welcome to Super Pulp Science, where we talk about how genre gets made. I'm here with my long-suffering co-host, Gregory Kamichuk, known the world over as GMB Kamichuk, and our producer, Dan Vadabunker. How's it going, guys?
Oh, it's so good to be here, Justin. Thank you so much for having me.
That was awesome.
Well done. Yeah,
I think like my brain shut off for that. It was just like parroting what I've heard so many times. I didn't have to think about it. It was kind of weird.
I like the known the world over as GMB Kamichuk. That's awesome.
Right, the world over. The world over. That's right. The world is over. You have some things to talk about today, Justin. So we've given you the reins of the podcast. You're in charge, and I am just going to. I'm going to take notes and draw pictures while you lead the whole affair. It's going to be great.
All right. I have a story that I thought would be great to share on the podcast because it's got everything. It's got,
chases, it's got escapes, true love.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, my online store has been open for a couple weeks now. I updated it with a whole bunch of awesome stuff. I've got canvases up there. I've got prints. I've got like exclusive stuff that I was only selling at conventions before. So a big part of my day has become taking orders and packaging them up and sending them all over the world. And I've learned a lot about shipping things and how to properly ship things and how to protect things when they get shipped, especially with shipping artwork, right? You're shipping something super light but very fragile. And so some of the some basic tips that I would give to anybody who's kind of getting into this, because this is, again, stuff I wish I had known a couple months to a couple years ago. Big tubes are great for artwork. So when I first was shipping artwork around, I tried to ship it flat because I didn't know if people would want things rolled. And that just was too unsafe. It's too unsafe to ship artwork flat. Things get bent. People will bend packages. It doesn't matter how many stickers you put on a box saying, do not bend me. Somebody's going to bend it four times to shove it into a mailbox. So tubes was a big thing. And then water damage became a big issue. I wasn't getting reports of damaged prints anymore, but I was getting reports of waterlogged prints. And
Tears, because it was so beautiful. They would just cry.
Yes.
And then the pieces would get water damaged.
Somebody who worked at an airport informed me that probably what was happening was things that were going further away, they when a lot of packages are waiting to be loaded onto planes, they kind of sit on the tarmac waiting to go, and they're not under anything, so they're exposed to the elements. So if you've got something that can, you know, susceptible to the rain, it's going to get some rain on it. So my latest trick to kind of cut down on tape and to protect things from water is I've gotten cellophane wrap, kind of like the stuff that they wrap pallets in, or you see them at the airport, they'll wrap entire suitcases in that cellophane wrap to protect things. So I got a hold of a couple rolls of that, and then that saves me from taping things up, and it also protects my stuff from water damage. Okay, so that was just, I wanted to let people know those tricks because those are things that I wish I had tried out or somebody had told me about earlier. But on to my story. So I had a person order a canvas and a couple pieces of artwork. And it was somebody who had ordered from me before. They were really excited about getting their stuff. The address system that I use for printing my labels has this great function with Canadian addresses. It basically, once you start putting in the address, it finds it and then auto-fills it for you. So you only have to put in the first part of the address, and then it just fills in the rest, and you can hit print. And the system works great, except for every once in a while, if it's a small town with like a PO box number or something, the system can't guess that. It can't figure it out. So it just finds the next closest thing, which sometimes is a drastically different place. So I've had like people from a small town send me an email saying like, hey, it says my package is delivered, but it says it's delivered in Ontario, and I'm definitely not from Ontario. So you might want to track that down. So I've learned to double check things, or so I had thought.
It's like when I mistype an address when I'm looking at something in my Google Maps. That's supposed to be in Winnipeg, and it says, you know, 27 beginning route, 27 hours to Minnesota.
Yes.
You know, it's like, nope, that's not where I was going.
So I've learned to double check things, but I usually only look at the first part of the address. And if it's found the first part of the address, it's found the rest, and that's served me well up until I sent off this canvas. So I sent it off. A couple days later, I get an email from the buyer saying, hey, it says my canvas has arrived, but I definitely didn't get it. So I'm kind of panicking at this point, because it's not like just a print or a little piece that I can replace. It's a big canvas that I sent off that has suddenly gone AWOL. So I look at the address that they gave me, and I look at the address that I had sent it to. And this particular customer is from Vancouver, Washington.
Uh-oh.
And I had put in Vancouver, Canada. And it just so happens that they have a street address in Vancouver, Washington that matches very closely to a Vancouver, Canada street address. And so the system was just like, oh, we know where that is. And I saw Vancouver. And so I kept my little thing in Canada. I didn't switch to the States. I just saw Vancouver and thought, hey, that's next by, that's nearby.
So right.
I'm panicking at this point, because I have sent a huge canvas to some place in Vancouver, and Canada Post can no longer help me, because they've delivered the package to the place it was going to, right? It's out of their hands. I gave them a package, they put it where it was supposed to go, and they dropped it off and they left. So in their system, it is labeled as delivered. They can't just go back and retrieve it, right? Like they've done their job.
I want to just interject briefly that, speaking of delivered, while you're telling this story of what's clearly frustration and stress, our neighbor has delivered freshly baked cookies. So for the dear listener, I am now enjoying a freshly baked oven warm cookie while I listen to Justin's heart. Please carry on.
We've had a good life together, haven't we, baby?
You know it, Poops.
So I have this weird address that I've sent a really expensive, like one of a kind artwork to, that is not very replaceable. Like I can print a new canvas. I can get this order refilled, but it's going to take a very long time, and it's going to be very expensive. So I'm panicking a little bit. And so then I try to reverse look up a phone number to an address. I have an address, but I have no idea who actually lives there or who I sent it to. So Canada has a 411, kind of like you can ask it things and it'll try to help you out. So I put in this address to Canada's 411. And a name and a phone number pops up. And I'm really excited because, oh my God, I think I found the person that I sent this to. So I phone.
Every stalker listening to our podcast is like, wait, you can just do that in Canada? Amazing.
Well, wait. Or so I thought. So I phone, and the phone number has this protective layer against scammer setup. So it prompts me to press a number when I phone, like, to ensure that you're a human being, please press 8. So it, you know, like it prompts me to, you know, say that I'm not a robot. So I press 8 and I'm connected to an older an older lady in Vancouver. And in my mind, I'm like, how the heck do I not sound like I'm trying to get, like, I'm a random person phoning her, you know.
Oh, not to be a scammer.
Yeah.
There's a package on your doorstep. You're like, when did that? Hey, I just saw like a special on one of these things the other day on these scammers.
About- so I explain, yeah, my name's Justin. I'm an artist from Winnipeg. I sent a package to your door by mistake.
If you just deposit a few dollars into my bank account, then we can unlock a whole host of things for you. Oh my gosh.
So the woman on the other end goes, no, 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 we didn't receive any packages today. And I double check. I look at the 411 number I called, and it turns out that 411 didn't find the address that I was looking for. It found the next closest thing. And so it gave me the address's neighbor's over phone number, because that's the only one it could find in the area. So I had phoned not the right house. I had phoned just a house in the area. And so I apologized and told her to have a good evening. So then I go back to my 411, trying to sleuth and detective my way into finding the right phone number, the right person. And all I can find is that the house has been sold. Somebody owns it, but I can't find any kind of connecting contact information or names or anything like that. So I'm at the end of my rope. And so I phone the lady back. So 15, 20 minutes later, I phone this woman back and go, hi, it's me again, Justin, the artist from Winnipeg. Here's the situation. Can you please write down my information and go a couple doors down and give them my phone number so I can make this right?
Did you tell and her the whole sort of tale, or did
I
you?
I told her the whole story. And I got her name at this point. This was Ruth from Vancouver, who is my new best friend.
The next closest thing, Vancouver Ruth.
Vancouver Ruth. So Ruth tells me that this is very strange. And I agree with her that this is very strange. But I'm not sure what else to do, how to make this right. But could you please go a couple doors down and give them this message and call me back at my number? So Ruth and I get off the phone, and about 20 minutes passes, and Ruth calls back. And it turns out that a very nice Chinese family has recently moved in there. Ruth didn't even know that anybody lived there. She thought the house was still vacant. But she managed to, talk to them. And they explained that they were home when the package arrived, and that they looked at it, saw that it was the wrong name, and actually refused the package. They gave it back to the post person. And so it actually was going back to the sorting center to be labeled as refused and come back to me. But in the postal service program, it has been listed as delivered. Like the last time it was scanned, it was delivered. So they didn't have that information yet. So I was kind of in between it being delivered and in between it being scanned back in as on my way back. So Ruth phoned back and told me what was going on. And I thanked her a million times. And I have a package of artwork and some of my books going to Ruth, because now I have her phone number and address from my detective work. And so I'm sending her a bunch of free artwork.
Yeah. That's great. Awesome.
But I thought that was such a great Canadian, just, hi, random stranger, can you help me get my package returned?
Down the street, yeah, and check on my artwork. What's great about this, it has all the same energy of our normal missing package, missing flight, stuff is in the wrong city kind of vibes. You were able to channel all that energy you would normally put into normally being in another city into making Ruth your buddy and your confidant in the hunt for this art. The next closest thing. That feels like that's the theme of our podcast today, is the next closest thing.
And I'm pretty sure that the reason for this was because some postal worker kind of probably jumped the gun and scanned it as delivered before he actually delivered it. And then
he got to the house, she got to the house, scanned it as I'm here, and then went to drop it off.
And then forgot to unscan it or whatever, forgot to change anything.
Well, I don't, Right? I don't think it gets rescanned in until it gets back at the sorting center. That's when it's coming back to is when that scan happens. I'm guessing. All this happened before that happened.
Yeah, okay. Never mind.
I was hoping that this story would end with her saying, no, I'm afraid they said they didn't get any packages, but they're just moving in. And oh man, did I ever see this great, beautiful canvas of artwork? They sure are art lovers. It's too bad they didn't get your package. I was hoping for.
She got her evening walk in. So she was great to have. She could help somebody out and get her evening walk in at the same time. So she thought that was just dandy.
Are you going to send her some Chasing Artwork branded sneakers?
I have some artwork that I think she would like. I have some pretty fine artsy pieces that I think she might get a kick out of, and a nice little handwritten note.
Did she seem of the vintage of someone that would have grandchildren? It's not a question you want to ask somebody you don't know. Like, tell me if there's any young people around you.
She did. So I thought I'd include a Quackers book as well. Somebody in her family might get a kick out of that. So. Mm-hmm.
Somebody somewhere always likes Quackers.
Yeah,
exactly. Quackers is the unsung hero of your book catalog. I haven't had any of those kinds of misadventures in a while, and I actually miss it. Is that weird? Is it weird?
No.
Did I miss being at the wrong gate? Or like, oh no, I'm sorry, sir. Like when I flew, what the hell was that airline? It's gone now. Was it
Flair?
Boop. Flair.
Oh, Flair, yeah.
Boop. One of those freaking ones. Yeah. It's literally, they flew us to the wrong city and we're like, oh, sorry. Well, the flight home is tomorrow. You know, those are great adventures. Then you hire a car and you drive the last 500 miles yourself.
That sudden drop in stress and panic, like, oh God, something really not convenient has happened. And then that rush of relief you get when somebody can, you know, you talk to the person who can make it all right. You know, like, it was one of those, like, it's all on me to try to figure this out. And then suddenly I had somebody to help me out with it, who was boots on the ground right there and was on my side. Was just, that was amazing, because I had no idea how else to solve this, right? Like, who do I convince to go to this possibly vacant house and steal a package off their doorstep and then mail it back to me? You know, like, how does that conversation work?
Yeah, like, how long do you have to, like, talk to Ruth, and, like, how much social capital about yourself do you have to share before you can win her to your cause to sneak to the neighbor's house, creep up onto the porch, and this is, that was it one of those Pokemon? Is it one of those huge ones?
No, it was my cat Ford. It was my original.
That was a sizable canvas too, though. Yeah.
Yeah, so it was a big canvas and a bunch of other stuff. Like, they ordered a lot of stuff, and they used the Dragon Nanny code, so they ordered a bunch of stuff and got a big discount code off of it because they were a Kickstarter backer.
Oh, so good. Those early adopters.
Yes. Well, anybody who got a Kickstarter got a discount code from my store. So I've been seeing a lot of people from the Kickstarter coming back. So yeah, that little experiment worked. Yeah.
All right. Be calm, everybody. The boat's insured.
It's amazing that as soon as you tell that story, my first inclination is like, how do we do something nice for Ruth? But if you're going to send her some books, I guess that's okay.
Yeah.
Next time you're in Vancouver, call her up and go for a coffee or you know, take her out for lunch.
Well, that's it. Like, Vancouver is a massive city. Take her for a walk. So I was running through, like, I know a bunch of people in Vancouver, but there's a very little chance they're going to live anywhere near where I sent this package. So even, like, you know, asking a friend to, like, hey, drive 2 hours across the city and steal a package for me is a pretty big ask on, like, an, you know, out of nowhere on an evening. So I was super glad to be able to track down Ruth.
You know what? That's something Sylvia would probably do. She would enjoy that. She would enjoy that. She would enjoy a heist. a heist, a call heist from Winnipeg. Dan, I'm wearing my my thing.
That's awesome. Old nice school art by Steve Call.
Yeah, Stephen Call doing some great artwork on that. I put on the shirt and I had a pang of nostalgia, and also it was happy memories. I thought it would make me sadder, but it actually made me happy because it was such a great show. And now it's like wearing a talisman. It's the next closest thing to being there, I guess. Mm-hmm. Dan, it's wearing the shirt. Wearing the shirt. Where are you guys at with events and things like that for FanQuest?
Still holding. It's everything's still up in the air, and I think we'll know more in the fall for sure. Like that's when you start to see. I am hopeful that we will have a con here before the end of the year, because you know we all hope things will be back to normal soon, and we'll be able to gather together again. So I'm optimistic about that. And if there is one, then you can expect FanQuest to come around next spring is what we're going for.
Oh, cannot wait.
Yeah, no kidding.
I'll help set up tables.
Oh, thank you. Oh, man. No. How about if you stay very end of the show? I was thinking about this. I just thought about this the other day. I'm like, I can't remember. I don't know where I was, and I was like experiencing this memory of breaking down FanQuest, but every year I have been the last one there by myself finishing the last few jobs. Like that's just, I guess, the way it is. And I kind of like it, actually. I kind of like being the last one to close it all down, but I wouldn't mind a little more help.
Go down with the ship.
Exactly. Go down with the ship. Except the ship is like sailed away already because the event is over.
Yeah, just left on the dock. I'm the next closest thing for me is for sure finishing iCollector. I'm 3 pages away from finishing iCollector. The 5th issue was supposed to be 22 pages, and it looks like it's going to weigh in at 32 pages because I just got carried away with the grand finale. And I keep calling up my collaborator, Dr. Jonathan Ball, recent Manitoba Book Award winner, Dr. Jonathan Ball. Congratulations, Jonathan, for The Lightning of Possible Storms. But I'm calling him up and saying, okay, so I have this idea, but I'm going to need to stretch out this fight scene for 2 more pages. Or, oh, I have this idea, but before we can make that horrible thing happen, we'll need a page leading up to it. So it just keeps like ballooning that last. I asked myself the other day, is it only getting bigger because I don't want it to be finished? Is it like the fear of finishing, you know, which sometimes happens near the end of a project. You don't quite want it to be over because you don't have a solid deadline. You don't have a release date. You don't have these things. So you just kind of keep working at it. But we had stuck so vehemently to the 22-page limit of the first 4 issues. And it's such a strange little story. It feels like if you stay to issue 5, then you're going to get a big payoff. At least that's what we hope. And tied up a bunch of things in a nice little bow. And what was interesting in the conversation, we'll get Jonathan on to talk to give his half of the story, but I was like, hey, there's like 2 plot holes in here, which I'm not sure if I'm just not smart enough to see that you've already solved them, or I think I fixed them this way. And he said that he had in his notes, because I was working on issue 1 by the time he was writing issue 5. So he hadn't seen some of the visual cues yet. So he just wrote in his notes, I'm sure Gregory will solve this. And then he forgot to come back to it. So when he went to look at his issue 5 notes, he's like, oh, wait. Oh, you fixed that thing. Okay, great. I guess I did know that you would fix it after all. So that's solved. So not a good solution to try and fix it by adding 10 more pages. But in this case, it did seem to be the way to go. So that's what I've been working on for the last little while. So in the afternoons, bumping between working really horrific dreamlike imagery of like a dream parasite, like eating parts of a family, homeschooling my kids. And then in the mornings, of course, visiting with Grey Force and doing doodling and drawing and storytelling. So it's been a pretty, like, my head has been turning on some interesting pivot points for the last little while. I'm not sure if it's good for me or not. But here we are.
the whiplash of going from kid appropriate drawings to the most horrible things you can think of drawing?
Well, it's yes, exactly. It's so funny because one of these very well-intentioned grade four kids, and we were talking about books and making books, asked, well, what are you working on now, Mr. C? What's the thing that you're working on your desk? Because I talked about it. You always have your stuff on your desk that you're working on, and it's okay to leave it aside when you're not, you know, whatever. Just giving them a little pep talk about how to like put things aside when you're not happy with it. What are you working on, Mr. C? Oh, well, and I immediately launch into my slug line of the eye collector, forgetting these are grade fours. So I'm like, oh, well, these, you know, these parents have convinced a dream parasite that they'll trade their little child's eyes for their hopes and dreams and all the things they ever want. And then there's these crickets on the Zoom call, and the teacher is like, clearly like a little bit like, oh my goodness, what are you talking about? And I'm just like, but that's not appropriate for young audiences. Here's a book about gnomes I did, and I happened to have our book Red and See-Through and Snow Troll's Daughter on hand, and I just tried to, like, the worst segue ever.
Well,
like,
actually, funny story about that. I talked to a class of grade threes today, and before I talked to them, the teacher reached out to talk about Red and See-Through, and she had some questions. And as I'm explaining Red and See-Through about how the girl is dead, it's her grave at the end, and it's the Grim Reaper that shows up to take her back home, I'm realizing, like, maybe this isn't the best book for a grade three class.
But it's drawn in your stuff. That's the thing about your artwork, Justin, right? It's the next closest thing. Here we go again. It's your style is so... I have to use a different prefix. It's unarresting. Like it has an animated style that is so approachable. That's the word I was looking for. Approachable, that even when the subject matter is a little bit grim, it never reads as overly frightening and hopeless. Where like my work, because there's so many deep blacks and so much like grit and scratches, if I were to draw your giant antler death shrouded creature that shows up at the end of your story, it would be the stuff of nightmares. But in yours, he kind of looks almost amused and not scary at all, and just like he happens to look like the Grim Reaper as opposed to like the menace and the aura. And her little ghostly shape is giving him such a big hug, and you got the little heart floating. It's fine. Just, yeah, don't explain it to people and it doesn't sound
When you have to distill it down, right? Like, I mean, if you have to distill a Toy Story down, possessed dolls try to get back into house is the same slug line as Annabelle.
Yeah,
right?
Right. Well, right, and what's mine in Snow Troll's Daughter, it's like a young child is abducted by a troll who covers his tracks by summoning the first snows of winter, right? Like, that's also a pretty grim way to start a little kid's adventure story, but that's where we are. It's very lighthearted. There's a cute little mouse, and you know, in the end he just trades the child back for a wooden doll that he makes for them.
It's no darker than the Grimm fairy tales that we all grew up on, right?
Those were very dark. Well,
right. But we were, I read Hansel and Gretel, like she's cooking up those kids. Like, that's the story.
You made that monster up out of thin air. Now don't try to tell me it's real. I'm not that stupid.
Well, I am. I always believed in it.
And it's funny too, because when I'm doing these calls with the kids, I just doodle. I have the camera set up so it's like looking down just onto my hands while I'm drawing, and I draw with a big Sharpie. And because you want the camera to show up regardless of the resolution of the kids, some of them are in quite northern communities, so their resolution is not, you know, the bandwidth is not great, so you just need it to be able to show up for everyone. I'm drawing very big, very cartoony, very like easy to follow along for kids. Like, a lot of them just draw everything I'm drawing right along with me while I'm talking and doing the lesson. So then when the teacher or when myself will show finished artwork in a different context, half the kids don't believe it could possibly be made by the same person. And then the other half, because they're already in front of their computers, they will Google and find many things that are not, you know, my body of work is not 100% kid appropriate on all levels. And so, ooh, this one looks great. Tell me about this one is kind of a tricky conversation sometimes. Well, let me tell you about Midnight City. There are these parasites that burrow into people's bodies, right? It's not really where you start with kids. So it's been interesting in that online space.
Do you know of any artists or creatives that operate under two brands? Like it happens with writers quite often, right? They'll have a false name that they write their erotic fantasy with, and then the real name, you know, but artists don't typically have two different brands operating at the same time.
Well, I can say that Jean Girard and Mobius were two brands, right? The artist that you know is Mobius. When he did his most commercial work, he used his real name, and his real name paid the bills. He was working on Blueberry and a bunch of comics that he did not own the copyright on, but because of French publishing, he had royalties for European publishing in general. He had royalties on those collections, which meant that his Jean Girard paid the bills and his Mobius was all his experimental work. And he became much more famous for his Mobius work later in life as a result of having no rules, but he couldn't have done it if Jean Girard hadn't been paying the bills with a little bit more traditional style animation at first, or pardon me, illustration at first. So there are precedents for it, but you know, guys like, you know, Neil Gaiman would be an example that springs to mind as somebody who just writes whatever he wants, whenever he wants, in whatever genre he wants. And he's a talented enough writer with a larger enough, following that he can make that work.
Have you felt that like want to have your work separated, like to have all your kid friendly stuff a little more searchable and separated from your other stuff in this situation? But no, not at all.
No. The dear listener cannot see me frowning and shaking my head. No, I think that over specialization is the death of nuance, and the death of nuance has led to so many of our horrible situations in the world today, that it's okay to be more than one thing, right? It's okay if you are more than one thing. That's what people are. Is there a collection of lots of disparate ideas, emotions, motivations, expressions? That's okay. You can take a whole person. So there was a while when it was tricky for me as a when I was actually in the classroom. And a kid would say, like, hey, I read Imagination Manifesto, pretty dark, Mr. C. What's with all the sex and violence? I thought you're supposed to be, like, a great example to us young people. And, you know, those conversations are interesting because what is the example you're supposed to set, right? So I'd throw that at you guys. What is the example that you're supposed to set as an author? Are you just supposed to do the thing that you're known for and just keep doing that endlessly, never changing, just because that's what your audience wants? Or, you know, is it okay that I write murder books on one side and kids books on the other?
I guess at a certain point, you really, like, if you are really widely known, like if you were like the Bernstein Bear couple, right? You had written
Stan and Jan.
Stan and Jan, right? And you wanted to start doing horror books, then you kind of have to, that one's tough, right? Because you have to know that people are expecting the one thing from you, and you don't want to not let them down, but kind of trick them into being exposed to something that might be a little too adult or a little too scary because they see your name on that book.
Yeah.
But
I mean, wasn't that the reason that Stephen King wrote under, I was going to say Randy Bachman, Richard Bachman, because those books weren't horror books. Like, he was known to be a horror writer primarily. And then he wanted to do other stuff. So he picked a pen name to do those books. He doesn't do that anymore, but he did at the time.
Right. Because how disappointed would you be if you picked up a Stephen King and
it wasn't a horror book, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I've definitely fallen into that trap. Like, I've complained about the Hearts of Atlantis.
You did.
I read his autobiography more than once, and I can say that he speaks to that there was a bit of a crisis of faith going on where he had become a name where his name was bigger than the title of the book on every book cover. Mm-hmm. And could he be a good writer without all of that hype? And so the Bachman books were a way of sending books to agents and to publishers without Stephen King's name attached to see if he was good enough to be published.
I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Yeah.
To kind of test them out.
Did they publish those books not knowing it was Stephen King? They must have found out at some point.
Correct. As I understand it, they found out eventually and were not pleased. And then that's where the whole thing started.
Okay, so they did publish the book not knowing that it was Stephen King. Okay, interesting.
Yeah, I'd have to.
I'll look into it. Yeah. I'll Google that. That sounds like fun. But it's still
fun. And I mean, what was it? Didn't J.K. Rowling try doing that?
Had another,
right? As soon as they found out, as soon as the book sales don't meet the hype that they hope they will, usually you then reveal who it really is, right? But then there's the other side of it where, like, someone like Joe Hill, who is a phenomenal writer in his own right, needs to worry not a whit about standing in someone's shadow. Being Stephen King's son, of course, you can't have King as your last name on a book cover, or everyone will just assume that the only reason you got there is because someone opened the door for you. But that's not actually how audiences are built. They have to like the book, right? You can probably sell a lot of copies of your first book being somebody's son, but you can't, or daughter, but you can't sell a lot of copies of your second book if they didn't show up for the first one. So it's interesting. Yeah, all that discussion about brand being like on point with all that, you know, we've had this talk before. I'll let my body of work, I guess, speak for itself, and that'll be it. Right? I'm not just, and the other side of it too is we have never had such a critical success that you have that burden of having to follow it up with something that matches, right? It makes enough for us to be pleased with the results, but not convinced that we must follow them up.
Yeah, not chained to it. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, like, even if you look at the only thing that's really the same in Cassian Tonk, Rust and Water, and Dragon Annie is the format of the books themselves, but the stories are quite different, you know, in their delivery and their execution. And we're just kind of, you know, and Old as Salt, Strong as the Sea will be an enormous departure from, you know, visually from what those other books feel like. So that'll be interesting to see how that's seen.
It is, it's like a fun fantasy to have every once in a while. Like, what if I just started up a new brand, new social media presence, and tried a different style? And I wonder if I could get a bit of a, you know, like, grow a new following starting from scratch. Am I good enough to start anew? Kind of like what Stephen King was doing with, you know, like, and we've had friends of ours who have done that, who have kind of started little side brands that ended up enveloping their original brand, like their little side experiment got more of a following and got more attention than what they were originally doing. And so they kind of like jump ship to this new brand.
Yeah, I was conflicted about that with this Moon Patrol book that I'm finishing up, because it's very different departure from my normal art style. And I thought, you know, should I just send it out under an assumed name? Like, I legitimately was like, I wonder if I can pretend to be a nobody, right? I'm 19 years old and I'm just made this book and here it is.
I don't know if that's going to work for you.
Right? And you just say, I will never do public appearances and I won't do that, but here's the book. Yeah, I mean, it's been done. People do it.
All those Cubans alone in the deep. This was a chance for Renzo to again become the sea monster.
One whose name I won't speak out loud. There was a person trying to make their name in indie comics, pretending to be a female creator, thinking that somehow their work was being biased against them because they were a male. They were a pretty misogynist person to begin with to come up with this idea. They thought they could finally break in if everyone thought it was a woman doing it. They were sorely mistaken because the work wasn't very good to begin with. And so they kept getting bad reviews and rejections no matter what name they had, right? So the work still has to be of a certain quality. People thinking that gatekeepers and line jumpers, it's not really as it's pronounced as you think it is. It really comes down to whether you've got a body of work that people will like. I would love to see you try that, Jillo, Justin.
I think I'm so ingrained in my in this specific style that I don't know if I could do something different enough that people wouldn't notice. Like, hey, you look like you're drawing just like this guy. You know?
And you could be like, F that guy. He sucks.
See, and I think we've talked about this idea before about like doing that on purpose, like creating a like a rival company to your own and like just to stir up online drama. Like, yeah, it's I would never do it's a horrible idea, but
yeah, it's a horrible idea, but we've seen it happen where you know, it's like wrestling, right? Those wrestlers. They pretend to hate each other's guts, but really they're good pals.
They're all good buddies.
You know what you could do though? I could almost guarantee you that if you took, so I was showing off Dragon Nanny to a group of students. These were grade eights actually. And they were so enamored with the end sheets that we have in the book, which are the sketches and the thumbnails and all of this stuff. If you had an Instagram account of just your little brush pen drawings, I bet you could, make some waves with that.
But then it becomes a juggling act of, you know, how much time do you spend on which identity, right? Like,
see, as I give up more and more social media interest, I want you to have more and more of it just to see if you'll crack.
You're just trying to make Justin darker. You want him to be like chasing artwork after dark. Let's get naughty.
No, his little doodles are so cute.
But we originally started talking about the difference between like for kids and for adults.
A lot of poor comics. Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. And, you know, like Connor McCready, who we've had as a guest on the podcast before, Last Witch is very dark. Like the last issue that just came out, issue 5. Whoa. But it's in context scary. So it's interesting because if I was looking at that issue 5, I would say, wow, I don't know if this book is for kids. But then if you put it together with issues 1-4, the buildup is so gradual and perfect that it is a scary payoff at the right moment. And so it's totally for kids. So that'll be a book that I think will be interesting to see in collected editions, how well it does. Because if a parent is flipping through, you know, the unfortunate truth is that people pick things out of context all the time to stand in for an entire body of work. And so it'll be interesting to see that. To me, anyway, I find such things to be of great interest. I am mildly obsessed, speaking of things that are of interest to me, with the death of the direct magazine market. I've been finding all these stuff in back issue bins of like old Warren publications like Goblin, and you know, like they published Vampirella and all this other stuff, but they also did a bunch of sword and sorcery books that they tried for a while. And man, the level of artistry on display in these old black and white magazines right as that whole industry was in decline, it's like they were reaching their peak illustration levels right at the time that people stopped picking up the format. I wonder I know it sounds funny, but like Instagram art tutorial, the level of artists on Instagram feel like that to me right now. It's like peaking. When my interest is at its all-time low, the level of work and actual craftsmanship on display and level of people sharing how they really do it is at its peak. It's incredible. I just, it's very, I'm in a weird place. Possibly it's because it doesn't feel like a proper stand-in for human interaction. I just need to phone more Ruths, maybe. Maybe I should just start randomly dialing.
Just hit up, 411 and start finding people.
I'm an artist from Winnipeg, I'll say. Yeah. Do you know my friend Ruth? She lives in Vancouver. Dan is just chuckling away over there. He has things to say, but he's not saying them.
I'm sorry.
Well, I do. I really miss, I used to get like a monthly subscription to like the PlayStation magazine, which came with a demo disc and like all these full of great artwork and like developer diaries of how games are coming along and stuff. And yeah, I miss that. But then I guess I'm getting kind of snippets of that from different sites on the internet that I frequent. It's just kind of, moved mediums. But I miss magazines. That was exciting.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I mean. I've been going through these back issues and just, they're new to me. So it's exactly like getting a brand new something. Speaking of things that were new to me, that is brand new out, might be hard to find these days because I think it's selling exceptionally well, is Barry Windsor Smith's new enormous book called Monsters. He has not put out a new, he's pretty famous for having done the Weapon X series for Marvel back in the day. He did Iron Man, 2099. He did a ton of from Daredevil, like he just worked all across the Marvel universe back in the 80s and 90s. A prolific artist, incredible. One of my favorite books that he ever did, he did for Malibu Comics, I believe, a book called Rune. He hasn't published anything or been really active in the book world for at least, I don't know, I want to say 14, 17 years. But during that time, he produced this 500-page graphic novel that he just released through Fantagraphics, I guess. I had pre-ordered my copy a year ago and then completely forgot about it. Like forgot that it was coming, forgot that it existed. Like a few other things happened over the last 12 months. So I was not preoccupied. And then this box arrived. This box, P.S. Justin, is the kind of box that they don't know how to ship a book in. It was destroyed. The book inside crumpled on all the corners. It had a hard ride. And my first thought when I opened it was like, oh my God, whatever's in here is ruined. And then when I saw that it was this 500 pages of artwork from Barry Windsor Smith, I didn't even care. I was like, oh, it's here. And Tara, my wife, is saying, well, but look at it. You should send it back. It's ruined. I'm like, no, this is mine. This is the one. This is the only one for me. Is this tattered, ruined Monsters is the one I have now. It's not that beat up, but it's pretty beat up. But it was really interesting to look at a body of work that someone so painstakingly and so carefully produced over such a long period of time. People not familiar with Barry Windsor Smith's work, just Google his name, artwork. Your mind will be blown. He does the most incredible pen and ink drawings, bar none. He's one of those creators that when you're looking at it, you finish five or six pages and you ask yourself, how did you build that much tension? It's just lines on paper. How did I care about this character and their suffering? They don't really exist, but there they are. It is such a great pace. And I realized that the long form book is something that we haven't really tackled, that I haven't tackled, something so
500
big.
Pages.
Yeah, because, and I'll say this, and I'm just going to be a nerdy about this book right now. There's about 40 pages at the beginning where you just are led along at such a slow and deliberate pacing that you know something is wrong with this character, but it's all being hidden from you. In the dialogue of the characters around them, in the way that his body language is showing that he's trying to hide part of his face, that he's always wearing these glasses. There's all these little cues that tell you that something is very, very wrong. And the book is so big that you also, it creates this magic of, I know that the answer is not immediately coming. Like in most comics, if it's 22 pages, you know that there's a reveal by the end of that book. Or yeah, if it's 100 pages, you know that the reveal is within 20 pages of your reach. Just knowing that I was that invested after 40 pages and that I had so much longer to go, I actually closed the book. I got a bookmark, closed the book, put it aside. And my kids were like, Dad, I thought you were super into that book. How come you're stopping? I'm like, I don't want it to be over too soon. I sipped this book over the course of like, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks. I just read 10 or 20 pages at a time and just marveled at it. It was such a wonderful, wonderful escape from everything. So I highly recommend Barry Windsor Smith's Monsters. Fantagraphics is not a sponsor of the podcast. They have no idea that we were going to speak for like the last, what was this, like 10 minutes, me just gushing about how much I love this book. Challenging subject matter, stuff that I would be like nervous to approach myself as a creator, and just like got right into the nitty-gritty of this incredible story.
Who are you?
Never mind who I am. It's the mission that counts.
Let's get on with it.
I love the idea of doing something like that length, 500 pages, but that's like, that's 2+ years of illustration that, you know, what's going to prop that up while you're making 500 pages of that book? You still got to keep the lights on and pay the bills. So you really need to have something else, like, and hopefully self-sustaining, right? Like if you can have just an online store that'll just keep moving things on your behalf, and you don't have to take on, you know, it's just, yeah, commissions and freelance and all those other projects that kind of take away from your 500 page book. How do you know how long it took him to make that?
I did a little bit of research around it, and depending on who's asking the question and who's getting the answer, they say anywhere between 10 years and 17 years he's been working on it.
Oh God. And the publisher too, like how did that work?
No. Did so the just... way it worked was he did it completely for himself. And then I believe it's Gary Groth, is that right? Is the publisher at Fantagraphics? I might have that wrong. So dear listener, forgive me if I did. Heard that he'd been working on a book, asked to see parts of it, saw some pages. And, you know, Barry Windsor Smith is apocryphally quite shy about showing his work. So, you know, it sort of came out that he had done this enormous thing, and they were like, wow, you're finished it? This is done? Well, let's publish it. It just was one of those things. He was doing it totally for himself to try and create a work that was challenging for himself as a creator. The kind of work that commercially most people would say it won't work in today's market. Didn't matter what year it was. That's exactly the kind of book you would, as a publisher, not undertake from somebody. So, you know, it's interesting. I'm too impatient to wait that long to put a book out, though.
It's also, I, now that I'm so knee deep in shipping things all the time, I think about how, okay, a book that size going places, like you're looking at like $30 plus just for shipping it, right? So what, and then to protect it, because it doesn't sound like it was overly protected. Oh, then no, add another, you know, $5-6 just of raw material to package it correctly. So now we're at $40 just to move it from A to B. And then now you have to attach a price tag on 10 years of story. Whew, it's an expensive book.
Yeah. And, you know, who knows what kind of deal there was, or if even at all. It could have been a, you know, it could have been the kind of book. Now, of course, this is just all our speculation now, but, you know, there are sometimes there are things you make, you finish, and you're just glad anyone cares at all. So you're not really attaching some like magnum opus life works price tag to it because you're just like, oh, wow, you like this? I didn't think anyone would like this. Sure.
Yeah, how often do the artists think they're working on their magnum opus when they are? Or is it just another Tuesday, you know?
I like to imagine it's just another Tuesday. I think anyone who's claiming that they're making a really genius piece of work, it
usually isn't that great.
Often it isn't. We've met all these people. Yeah. Right? Everyone who tells you how great the book's going to be. Now, when it's finished, you can speak to its merits. Like, we're proud of all the work that we've done. Right. But there's no way that I would stand on a pulpit and tell everyone that it's the best book in the genre related to the, like, some people do that. Like, some people, they just are unafraid to claim that their book is the greatest book ever written of its type. But then they tend to sell a lot more of them as a result. So it's hard to know. Are people that gullible? Like, when you hear that from someone?
You almost want somebody like that on your team every once in a while. Like, I don't want to be that person, but I kind of want them on my marketing team to push the book.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. I don't mind being that guy for you. I push your work constantly because I see in you things I can't do. So that's what I champion. I think that's aspirationally why artists support other artists. They're usually champions of work that they understand how it's done, but couldn't figure out how to do it necessarily. Right? Like, I understand your process, but I couldn't replicate it. And so that's why I'm always telling people, like, oh, look at this. Look at this. Amazing. In 1,000 years, you couldn't figure out how to put this together in the same way. So it's like that.
It's weird how in the art discipline, it's so who's super cocky about their work, but in other disciplines, like especially like in like music, you know, it's almost like expected that you should be really boisterous about what you're capable of. Is it because we work from home in the shadows and basements and don't like coming out, you know, like it's why aren't artists more cocky?
Yeah. You know what? I think because we spend most of our lives with other people asking us what it's for, what use it's supposed to have. And that kind of settles over you kind of like silt at the bottom of the river, right? A little bit after one day, you'd shake that right off. But after a lifetime, it becomes like a pretty like sedimentary rock, right? Just holding you fast to a place. It's not built on truth, but it just builds up over time that it's not of use, not of value. I think that's part of it. And the other thing too is if you make art at all, you know there's people better at it than you. Doesn't matter who you are. There's someone that you look up to and admire who, when you see their work, it takes your literal breath out of your body for a moment. And you're completely captivated by the puzzle of how it was done. And so it gives you a reason to be humble around other people's work, I think.
It's not as easily quantifiable as, say, you know, you're the number one fighter in your division or that weight class, or you sold more records than anybody else in your category or genre. We don't really have those quantifiers like a lot of other genres do, right? Like, how much is a piece of art worth is totally all over the map and like hard to nail down. So it's just this Mobius thing that we're all a little shy about.
Yeah. And so many artists that are considered like greats, you know, we all know died penniless and unrecognized in their lifetime. And so you also have that specter of being good isn't enough.
At least not while you're alive.
Is that how we're ending the podcast? Being good
is great.
Maybe you'll be the next closest thing. And Ruth will answer the phone for you.
Yep.
Should we make a little comic strip called Vancouver Ruth about an art thief, a little old lady art thief?
In my head, the entire time I was talking to her, I was trying to reverse engineer this as to how can I make sure she doesn't think this is a scam?
Right.
How, if this was a scam, how would it work so I can avoid doing and saying
those
things?
Just don't ask her for any bank account information. Just don't ask her for any type of personal information, right?
But you knew her name was Ruth, or did she tell you her name
was Ruth? That was like the very, like, on call number three, I asked, because again, I didn't want to push her for any information. So I think like the third time we talked, I asked so I could thank her properly. And
yeah, this calls to mind a time when you booked an Airbnb for me. I forget, we were in the Clutch somewhere and I was like, I needed a place. And you're like, oh, I got your spot. We were in Vancouver. No, it was Toronto. It was for a Toronto event. And so right. I'm in the Airbnb and there's three people there who are sharing this like enormous apartment, but they can't afford it. They're all professionals. Like two of them were lawyers and one of them was a model and they couldn't afford it. So they had to also Airbnb. And their fourth roommate comes back who works as a security specialist for some other company. Takes one look at me and calls everyone over to him at the table, but like, leaves me out of it. And then they confront me that I'm not you. That he's noticed that my face and the face of the person who booked the Airbnb do not match. And he catches it right away. And he wants to know, he wants, you know, sir, you got some explaining to do, is basically where we're at with this moment. And as my ID, I took out copies of my books that had my picture printed on the back. And I was like, listen, I'm an author. Here's me. Here's how I can prove that I'm who I say I am. If you Google this name and Justin's name together, you'll see we work on books together. But this guy was, and that actually put it to rest. They understood. The story held water. But for a moment when I said, wait, I can prove it to you. And I had my hands up in the air. I can prove it to you. And I ran back into the little bedroom that I was staying in. I can only imagine what scam they thought I was going to come out with.
You come out with the real Justin Curry's head in a plastic bag.
That's right. He's here with me. He's here with me.
I've got him right here. He'll tell you everything. So, he won't stop talking. What a chatterbox.
Ever since then, I've made sure that I've had a book that had my face on the back of it somewhere in my luggage when I'm traveling. So if I ever have to confirm my identity. So,
because your passport's not good enough.
Well, sometimes when I travel, I would lock it in a safe in the hotel. Oh, yes,
that's true.
Whatever,
that's true.
Which is funny because, you know, in retrospect, having worked in the hotel industry in my misspent youth, those things are not secure. So it's just the illusion of security that you've put it in there. But everyone who works in that hotel can also open that safe. I want you all listening to know that.
All right.
Gentlemen, I have enjoyed our conversation. It has ranged wildly. We've gone to Vancouver.
It has been a roller coaster of a convention. Yeah.
It's gone to Vancouver and back, and with a sidestep in Washington. This has been Super Pulp Science. This is Gregory Kamichuk encouraging you to join the fight and make comics. But wait, Justin, you're the host of this episode. You're supposed to say that.
Ditto.